Thanks to you.
Cam took Luce's hand. His eyes were bright green, the first color that had ever stood out to her in the grim, dreary world of Sword and Cross. He tilted his head and swallowed, considering his words carefully. He drew her close, and for a moment she thought he was going to kiss her. Her heart pounded as his lips bypassed hers and came to a stop, whispering in her ear.
Don't let him flip you off next time.
You know I won't, she laughed.
Ah, Daniel, a mere shadow of a true bad boy.
He pressed his hand to his heart and raised an eyebrow at her.
Make sure he treats you well. You deserve the best of everything there is.
For once, she didn't want to let go of his hand. What will you do?
When you are ruined, there's so much to choose from. Everything opens up.
He looked past her into the distant desert clouds.
I'll play my role. I know it well. I know goodbye.
He winked at Luce, nodded one final time at Daniel, then rolled back his shoulders, spread his tremendous golden wings, and vanished into the roiling sky. Everyone watched until Cam's wings were a fleck of far-off gold. When Luce lowered her eyes, they fell on Lucifer. His skin had its lovely shimmer, but his eyes were glacial. He said nothing, and it seemed he would have held her in his gaze forever if she hadn't turned away. She had done all she could for him. His pain was not her problem anymore. The voice boomed from the throne.
One more goodbye.
Together, Luce and Daniel turned to acknowledge the throne, but the second their eyes fell upon it, the stately figure of the woman blazed into white-hot glory, and they had to shield their eyes. The throne was indiscernible again, a gathering of light too brilliant to be gazed upon by angels.
Hey, guys, Arian sniffed. I think she meant for you two to say goodbye to each other.
Oh, Luce said, turning to Daniel, suddenly panicked. Right now? We have to... He took her hand. His wings brushed hers. He kissed the centers of her cheeks.
I'm afraid, she whispered. What did I tell you?
She sifted through the million exchanges she and Daniel had ever shared, the good, the sad, the ugly. One rose above the clouds of her mind. She was shaking.
That you will always find me. Yes, always, no matter what.
Daniel!
I can't wait to make you the love of my mortal life.
But you won't know me. You won't remember. Everything will be different. He wiped away her tear with his thumb.
And you think that will stop me?
She closed her eyes.
I love you too much to say goodbye. It isn't goodbye.
He gave her one last angelic kiss and embraced her so tightly she could hear his steady heartbeat overlapping her own.
It's until we meet again.
20. Perfect strangers, 17 years later. Luce clipped her dorm room key card between her teeth, craned her neck to swipe it through the lock, waited for the small electric click, and opened the door with her hip. Her hands were full. Her collapsible yellow laundry basket was heaped with clothes, most of which had shrunk during their first dryer cycle away from home. She dumped the clothes onto her narrow bottom bunk, amazed she'd found a way to wear so many different things in so short a span of time. The whole week of freshman orientation at Emerald College had passed in a disconcerting blur. Nora, her new roommate, the first person outside Luce's family to see her wearing her retainer, but it was cool because Nora had one too, was sitting in the windowsill, painting her nails and talking on the phone. She was always painting her nails and talking on the phone. She had a whole bookshelf devoted to nail polish bottles and had already given Luce two pedicures in the week they'd known each other.
I'm telling you, Luce isn't like that.
Nora waved excitedly at Luce, who leaned against the bed frame, eavesdropping.
She's never even kissed a guy. Okay, once. Lou, what was that shrimpy kid's name from summer camp, the one you were telling me about?
Jeremy? Luce wrinkled her nose.
Jeremy! But it was like truth or dare or something. Child's play. So yeah.
Nora, Luce said, is this really something you need to share with... Who are you even talking to?
Just Jordan and Haley.
She stared at Luce.
We are on speaker. Wave!
Nora pointed out the window at the dusky autumn evening. Their dorm was a pretty U-shaped white brick building with a small courtyard in the middle where everyone hung out all the time. But that wasn't where Nora was pointing. Directly across from Luce and Nora's third-floor window was another third-floor window. The pane was up, tan legs dangled out, and two girls' arms appeared, waving.
"Hi, Luce!" one of them shouted.
Jordan, the spunky strawberry blonde from Atlanta, and Haley, petite and always giggling, with thick black hair that fell in dark cascades around her face. They seemed nice, but why were they discussing all the boys Luce had never kissed? College was so weird. Before Luce had driven the 1,900 miles up to Emerald College with her parents a week earlier, she could have named each time she'd been outside Texas. Once for a family vacation to Pikes Peak in Colorado, twice for regional championship swim meets in Tennessee and Oklahoma. The second year, she beat her own personal best in freestyle and took home a blue ribbon for the team. And the yearly holiday visits to her grandparents' house in Baltimore. Moving to Connecticut to go to college was a huge deal for Luce. Most of her friends from Plano Senior High were going to Texas schools. But Luce had always had the feeling that there was something waiting for her, way out in the world, that she had to leave home to find it. Her parents supported her, especially when she got that partial scholarship for her butterfly stroke. She'd packed her whole life into one oversized red duffel bag and filled a few boxes with sentimental favorites she couldn't part with. The Statue of Liberty paperweight her dad had brought her back from New York, a picture of her mom with a bad haircut when she was Luce's age, the stuffed pug that reminded her of the family dog, Mozart. The cloth along the bucket back seats of her battered Jeep was frayed, and it smelled like cherry popsicles, and that was comforting to Luce. So was the view of the back of her parents' heads as her father drove the speed limit for 4 long days up the East Coast, stopping from time to time to read historical markers and take a tour at a pretzel factory in northwestern Delaware. There had been one moment when Luce thought about turning back. They were already 2 days' drive from home, somewhere in Georgia, and her dad's shortcut from their motel to the highway took them out along the coast, where the road got pebbly and the air started to stink from all the skunk grass. They were barely a third of the way up to school, and already Luce missed the house she'd grown up in. She missed her dog, the kitchen where her mom made yeast rolls, and the way, in late summer, her father's rose bushes grew up around her windowsill, filling her room with their soft scent and the promise of fresh-cut bouquets. And that was when Luce and her parents drove past a long, winding driveway with a high, foreboding gate that looked electrified like a prison. A sign outside the gate read in bold black letters, "Sword and Cross Reform School."
"That's a little ominous," her mother chirped from the front seat, looking up from her home remodeling magazine. "Glad you're not going to school there, Luce."
"Yeah," she said. "Me too." She turned and watched out the back window until the gates disappeared into the winding woods. Then, before she knew it, they were crossing into South Carolina, closer to Connecticut and her new life at Emerald College, with every revolution of the Jeep's new tires. Then she was there, in her dorm room, and her parents were all the way back home in Texas. Luce didn't want her mom to worry, but the truth was, she was desperately homesick. Nora was great. It wasn't that. They'd been friends since the moment Luce walked into the room and saw her new roommate tacking up a poster of Albert Finney and Audrey Hepburn from Two for the Road. The bond cemented when the girls tried to make popcorn in the seedy dorm kitchen at 2 in the morning the first night and succeeded only in setting off the fire alarm, sending everyone outside in their pajamas. The whole week of orientation, Nora had gone out of her way to include Luce in every one of her many plans. She'd gone to a fancy prep school before Emerald, so she walked into college orientation already assimilated to life inside a dorm. It didn't seem weird to her that there were boys living next door, that the online campus radio station was the only acceptable way to listen to music, that you had to swipe a card to do anything around here, that class papers would have to be a whopping 4 pages long. Nora had all these friends from Dover Prep, and she seemed to make 12 more every day, like Jordan and Haley, still dangling and waving through their window. Luce wanted to keep up, but she had spent her whole life in a sleepy nook of Texas. Things were slower there, and now she realized that she liked it that way. She found herself pining for things she'd always said she hated at home, like country music and gas station fried chicken on a stick. But she'd come to school up here to find herself, for her life to finally begin. She kept having to tell herself that. "Jordan was just saying their next-door neighbor thinks you're cute." Nora gave Luce's wavy, waist-length dark hair a tug. "But he's a player, so I was making it clear that you, dear, are a lady. You want to go over there in a few and pre-party before that other party I told you about tonight?" "Sure." Luce popped the top on the Coke she'd bought at the vending machine, near the powder detergent-strewn laundry stations. "I thought you were bringing me a diet." "I did." Luce reached into her laundry basket for the can she'd bought for Nora. "Sorry, I must have left it downstairs. I'll run and get it. Be right back." "Pas de prob," Nora said, practicing her French. "But hurry. Haley says there's a varsity soccer team infiltration on their side of the hall. Soccer boys equal good parties. We should head over there soon." "Gotta go," she said into the phone. "No, I'm wearing the black shirt. Luce is wearing yellow. Or are you going to change? Either way." Luce waved to Nora that she'd be right back and ducked out of the room. She took the stairs two at a time, winding down the floors of the dorm until she stood on the tattered maroon carpet at the entrance to the basement, which everyone on campus called the pit, a term that made Luce think of peaches. At the window, looking out into the courtyard, Luce paused. A car full of boys was stopped in the circular drive of the dorm. As they climbed out, laughing and shoving each other, Luce saw they all had emerald varsity soccer shirts on. Luce recognized one of them. His name was Max, and he'd been in a couple of Luce's orientation sessions that week. He was seriously cute. Blonde hair, big white smile, typical prep school boy look, which she recognized now, after Nora had drawn her a diagram the other day at lunch. She'd never talked to Max, not even when they were teamed up with a few other kids on the campus scavenger hunt. But maybe if he was going to be at the party that night. All the boys getting out of that car were really cute, which for Luce equaled intimidating. She didn't like the thought of being the one shy girl in Jordan and Haley's room upstairs. But she did like the thought of being at the party. What else was she supposed to do? Hide in her dorm room because she was nervous? She was obviously going to go. She jogged down the final flight of stairs to the basement. It was getting close to sunset, so the laundry room had emptied, giving it a lonely glow. Sunset was the time you wore the things you'd washed and dried. There was just one girl in crazy thigh-high striped knee socks, savagely scrubbing a stain from a tie-dyed pair of jeans, as if all her future hopes and dreams depended on the stain's removal. And a boy, sitting atop a loud and shaking dryer, tossing a coin in the air and catching it in his palm.
"Heads or tails?" he asked when she walked in.
He had a square face, wavy amber hair, big blue eyes, and a tiny gold chain around his neck.
"Heads."
Luce shrugged and gave a little laugh. He flipped the coin, caught it, and flipped it over into his palm, and Luce saw that it wasn't a quarter. It was old, really old, a dusty golden color, with faded writing and another language's script. The boy raised an eyebrow at her.
"You win. I don't know what you won yet, but that's probably up to you.
She twirled around, searching for the diet soda she'd left down there. Then she saw it, about an inch from the boy's right knee.
This isn't yours, is it? She asked.
He didn't answer. He just stared at her with icy blue eyes, which she saw now suggested a profound sadness that didn't seem possible in someone his age.
I left it down here earlier. It's for my friend. My roommate, Nora, Lou said, reaching for the can.
This boy was strange, intense. She was blabbering.
I'll see you later.
One more time, he asked.
She turned around in the doorway. He meant the coin game.
Oh, heads.
He flipped. The coin seemed to hover in the air. He caught it without looking, flipped it over, and opened his palm.
You win again, he sang,
in a voice eerily identical to that of Hank Williams, a favorite old singer of Luce's dad. Back upstairs, Luce tossed Nora the Coke.
Have you met the crazy coin toss guy in the laundry room?
Luce, Nora squinted.
When I run out of underwear, I buy new underwear. I am hoping to make it to Thanksgiving without having to do laundry. Are you ready? Soccer boys are waiting, hoping to score. We are their goal, but we must remind them they can't use their hands.
She took Luce by the elbow and steered her out of the room.
Now, if you meet a boy named Max, I suggest avoidance. I went to Dover with him, and I'm positive he'll be on the soccer team. He will seem cute and very charming, but he has the biggest bitch of a girlfriend back home. Well, she thinks she's his girlfriend,
Nora murmured behind her hand.
And she got rejected from Emerald and is ferociously bitter about it. She's got spies everywhere.
Got it, Luce laughed, frowning inside. Stay away from Max.
What's your type, anyway? I mean, I know you've moved on from gangly old Jeremy.
Nora, Luce gave her a little shove.
You're not allowed to bring him up all the time. That was late-night roommate private conversation. What happens in pajamas stays in pajamas.
You're totally right,
Nora nodded, putting up her hands in surrender.
Some things are sacred. I respect that. Okay, if you had to describe your dream kiss in 5 words or less.
They were walking around the second bend of the U-shaped dorm. In a moment, they would turn the corner and approach the end of the hall, called the caboose, where Jordan and Haley's room was. Luce leaned against the wall and sighed.
I'm not embarrassed about having, you know, no experience, Luce said quietly.
These walls were thin.
It's just, do you ever feel like nothing has happened to you? Like you know you have a destiny, but all you've seen of life so far is unexceptional?
I want my life to be different. I want to feel that it's begun. I'm waiting for that kiss. But sometimes I feel like I could wait forever and nothing would ever change.
I'm in a hurry, too.
Nora's eyes had gone a little fuzzy.
I know what you mean, but you do have at least a little control, especially when you stick with me. We can make things happen. Our first semester's barely even started, kid.
Nora was eager to get to the party, and Luce wanted to go. She really did. But she was talking about that indescribable thing that was bigger than having a good time at a party. She was talking about a destiny that Luce felt like she had as much control over as the outcome of a coin toss, something that was and wasn't really in her hands.
You okay?
Nora tilted her head at Luce. A short auburn curl flopped down over her eye.
Yeah,
Luce nodded nonchalantly.
I'm good.
They went to the party, which was just a bunch of open dorm room doors and freshmen walking into and out of them. Everyone had plastic cups filled with a super sweet red punch that seemed to replenish itself automatically. Jordan DJ'd from her iPod, shouting, "Holla!" every now and then. The music was good. Her sweet next-door neighbor, David Franklin, ordered pizza, which Haley improved by adding fresh oregano from the herb garden she'd brought from home and installed in the corner by the window. These were good people, and Luce was glad to know them. Luce met 20 students in 30 minutes, and most of them were boys, who leaned in and put their hands on the small of her back when she introduced herself, as if they couldn't hear her otherwise, as if touching made her voice clearer. She realized she was keeping an eye out for the coin toss guy from the laundry room. 3 cups of punch and 2 slices of amazing thin-crust pepperoni pizza later, Luce had been officially introduced to, and then spent the next 10 minutes trying to avoid Max. Nora was right. He was good-looking, but way too flirtatious for someone with a crazy girlfriend back home. She and Nora and Jordan were crammed on Jordan's bed, whispering ratings for all the boys there, in between fits of giggles, when Luce decided that she'd had a little too much mystery punch. She left the party and slipped down the stairs, seeking quiet air. The night was cool and dry, nothing like Texas. This breeze refreshed her skin. There were a few stars out and a few kids in the courtyard, but no one Luce knew, so she felt free to sit down on one of the stone benches between 2 stout peony bushes. They were her favorite flowers. She'd taken it as a good omen when she saw the grounds around her dorm were blooming with them, even at the end of August. She fingered the deeply lobed petals of one of the full white blossoms and leaned forward to breathe in its soft nectar. "Hello." She jumped. With her nose buried in a flower, she hadn't seen him approach. Now, a pair of ragged Converse sneakers was standing right in front of her. Her eyes traveled up. Faded jeans, a black T-shirt, a thin red scarf tied loosely around his neck. Her heart picked up, and she didn't know why. She hadn't even seen his face. Short, golden hair, obscenely soft-looking lips. Eyes so gorgeous that Luce sucked in her breath. "I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean to scare you." What color were his eyes? "That's not why I gasped. I mean..." The flower fell from her hand, 3 petals landing on the boy's shoes. "Say something. He loves me. He loves me not. He loves me. Not that." It was physically impossible to say anything. Not only was this guy the most incredible thing Luce had ever seen in all her life, he'd walked up to her and introduced himself. The way he was looking at her made Luce feel as if she were the only other person in the courtyard, as if she were the only other person on Earth. And she was blowing it. Instinctively, she reached up to touch her necklace and found her neck was bare. That was strange. She always wore the silver locket her mother had given her on her 18th birthday. It was a family heirloom containing an old picture of her grandmother, looking very much like Luce, taken right around the time she'd met the man who had become her grandfather. Had she forgotten to put it on that morning? The boy tilted his head in a kind of smile. Oh, no. She'd been staring at him this whole time. He raised his hand, as if to give a little wave. But he didn't wave. His fingers hovered in the air. And her heart started pounding, because all of a sudden, she had no idea what this stranger would do. He could do anything. A friendly gesture was just one possibility. He could flip her off. She probably deserved to be flipped off for staring at him like a crazy stalker. That was ridiculous. She was being ridiculous. He waved, as if to say, "Hello in there."
"I'm Daniel."
When he smiled, she saw that his eyes were beautifully gray, with just a hint of... Was that violet? Oh, God, she was going to fall in love with a guy with purple eyes. What would Nora say? "Luce," she finally managed. "Lucinda."
"Cool." He smiled again. "Like Lucinda Williams, the singer."
"How did you know that?" No one ever guessed Lucinda Williams. "My parents met at a Lucinda Williams concert in Austin, Texas," she added. "Where I'm from."
"Essence is my favorite of her albums. I listened to it for half the drive out here from California." "Texas, eh? Big adjustment coming to Emerald."
"Total culture shock." It felt like the most honest thing she'd said all week.
You get used to it. I did, after 2 years, anyway.
He reached out and touched her shoulder when he noticed her panicked expression.
I'm kidding. You look much more adaptable than I am. I'll see you next week and you'll be completely settled in, wearing a sweatshirt with a big E on it.
She was looking at his hand on her arm. But more than that, she was experiencing 1,000 tiny explosions inside her, like the finale of a fireworks show on the 4th of July. He laughed, and then she laughed, and she didn't know why. Do you? She couldn't believe she was about to say this to a model, gorgeous upperclassman from California. Want to sit down?
Yeah,
he said instantly, then glanced up at the window where the lights were on and the party was happening.
You wouldn't happen to know about a soccer party going on somewhere in there?
Luce pointed, slightly crestfallen. I was just there. It's right up the stairs.
No fun?
It was fun, she said. I just...
Thought you'd catch your breath?
She nodded.
I was supposed to meet a friend.
Daniel shrugged, looking up at the window where Nora was flirting with someone they couldn't see.
But maybe I already have.
He squinted at her, and she wondered, horrified, if she'd been talking to him with flower pollen dusting her nose. Wouldn't be the first time.
Are you taking cell biology this semester? He asked.
No way. I barely got out of there alive in high school. She looked at him, at his eyes, which were most definitely a shade of violet. They glowed when she said, Why do you ask? Daniel shook his head, as if he'd been thinking something that he didn't want to say aloud.
You look so familiar. I could have sworn we've met somewhere before.
Epilogue. The stars in their eyes.
I love this part, Arian squealed.
Three angels and two Nephilim were sitting on the forward edge of a low gray cloud above a U-shaped dormitory in central Connecticut. Roland grinned at her.
Don't tell me you've seen this one before.
His marbled gold wings were extended and folded flat like a picnic blanket at a drive-through in the sky, so that Miles and Shelby could sit on them and stay aloft. The Nephilim had not seen the angels in more than a dozen years. Though Roland, Arian, and Annabelle bore no physical signs of this passage of time, the Nephilim had aged. They wore matching wedding bands, and the sides of their eyes were creased with the laugh lines made by years of happy marriage. Under his very faded blue baseball cap, Miles's hair was slightly gray around the temples. His hand rested on Shelby's belly, which protruded with a baby due the following month. She rubbed her head, like she'd narrowly escaped a concussion.
But Luce doesn't eat pepperoni. She's a vegetarian.
That's what you took away from this scene.
Annabelle rolled her eyes.
Luce is different now. She's the same girl, with different details. She doesn't see announcers, and she hasn't been to every shrink on the eastern seaboard. She's much more normal, which bores her to tears, but...
Annabelle grinned.
I think, in the long run, she's going to be really happy.
Does this popcorn taste burnt to you?
Miles asked, chewing loudly.
Don't eat that, Roland said, plucking the popcorn from Miles's palm. Arian got it out of the trash after Luce set the dorm room kitchen on fire.
Miles began spitting frantically, leaning over the edge of Roland's wings.
It was my way of connecting with Luce,
Arian shrugged.
But here, if you must, have some milk duds.
Is it weird that we are watching the two of them like a movie? Shelby asked.
We should imagine them like a novel or a poem or a song. Sometimes I feel oppressed by how reductive the filmic medium is.
Hey! Roland didn't have to fly you out here in Nephilim, so don't act smart, just watch.
Look! Arian clapped. He's totally staring at her hair. I bet he goes home and sketches it tonight. How cute!
Arian, you got way too good at being a teenager, Roland said. How long are we going to watch for? I mean, don't you think they've earned a little privacy?
He's right, Arian said. We have other things in our celestial plates. Like...
Her smirk faded, and she couldn't seem to think of anything.
So do you guys see each other anymore?
Miles asked Arian, Annabelle, and Roland.
Since Roland's, you know...
Of course we see him.
Annabelle smiled at Roland.
Because we're still working on him, even after all these years. The throne invented forgiveness, you know.
Roland shook his head.
I don't think heavenly redemption is in the cards for me anytime soon. Everything's so white up there.
You never know, Arian chimed in. We get to being mighty open-minded sometimes. Swing by and say hello.
Remember, it's because of the throne that Daniel and Luce are getting together right now. Roland grew serious, looking past the scene below, into the dark and distant clouds.
The balance between heaven and hell was perfect last time I checked. You don't need me tipping the scales.
There's always at least the hope of us all coming together once again, Annabelle said. Luce and Daniel are an example of that. No punishment is eternal.
Maybe not even Lucifer's.
Anyone heard from Cam? Shelby asked.
For a few moments, the clouds were quiet. Then Shelby cleared her throat and turned to Miles.
Well, speaking of things that aren't eternal, our babysitter's shift is almost up. She charged us overtime last week when the Dodgers game went into extra innings.
Do you want to heads up when Lisa and Daniel have their first date? Annabelle asked.
Miles pointed down to Earth.
Aren't we supposed to leave them alone?
We'll be there, Shelby said.
Don't listen to him.
To Miles, she said,
don't talk.
Roland wrapped the Nephilim under each arm and prepared to take flight. Then the angels, the demon, and the Nephilim flew off to distant corners of the sky, leaving a moment's brilliant flash of light behind them, as below, Luce and Daniel fell in love for the first and the last time.
Hi there, this is Justine Eyre, and we are over at the Random House Audio Studios in Los Angeles. And today we have the absolute pleasure of being with Lauren Kate, the author of Rapture. In the first book, Cameron came so close to wooing Luce's heart. He was like the quintessential bad boy that we all love. And then as the series progressed, he became more clearly bad. Were you ever tempted to have Cam win out for a while longer over Daniel when it came to Luce's heart? Do you think Cam would have fallen truly in love with Luce? Or would his alliance with the devil have stopped that?
I'll tell you a little secret about Cam. He is actually based on my husband. And so when I first started writing the series, I knew he was the bad guy. I knew he was going to be... I knew ultimately he didn't and shouldn't really have a chance with Luce, but I thought he was going to be a more stable, static form of a bad guy. But the thing that happens, I suppose, when you base your villain on your husband is that you fall in love with your villain. And so Cam's character changed in a lot of very surprising ways to me. He's probably the most different out of all the characters from the way I originally conceived of him. And so by the time I finished writing Fallen, I knew that Cam had his own story, which we get a little taste of in Passion. But I think I'm still holding on to trying to figure out how Cam's ending will play out. And so you can expect to maybe see some more of that. We'll see. But I did have to, you know, sort of slap myself every once in a while and say, Daniel's the one for her. Like, back off from this guy that you happen to be in love with.
Well, I have to comment about how you've made us all fall in love with your husband. We've all got crushes on your husband. Wow, that's really amazing stuff. The third and fourth books cover a lot of land, literally. Did you travel to any of those exotic destinations prior to writing about them? Or, I guess, obviously in the case of ancient Egypt and war-torn Russia, since you weren't able to time travel, did you have to do a lot of research to get a feel for those specific time periods?
I did get to travel some. I chose some of the settings based on places either that I had, that had inspired me when I visited them or that I dreamed of going to. For example, the Mexican setting when she's in Chichen Itza. I had been down there and looked at those ruins a few years ago, and I thought, this is such a fascinating society. I would love to write about this. I will never write about this. I will never write a whole novel about Chichen Itza, ancient Mayan culture. But when I got to Passion, it became this perfect place to go for 20 pages and spend a chapter. It was kind of like being there on a vacation. But for a lot of the settings, I had to turn to literature. The war-torn Moscow comes from a favorite book of mine called The Master and Margarita by Bulgakov. Obviously, there's a lot of Victorian literature influences in the Helston chapters. There's Shakespeare in there. There's the Milan Hospital is Hemingway, Farewell to Arms. So I turned to a lot of my favorite books and I said, what are the settings that move me? What are the settings that really plant me deep inside of them? And that's what I wanted to give to my readers. So I kind of just yanked their settings and plopped them in my book to see what they would do.
The depiction of the fall in the third book was extremely vivid. How did you prepare for the writing of that scene? Were there any paintings or music or outside sources that inspired you? Because for me, it felt like you gave us an insider's view of heaven. It was really amazing.
I'm certainly very inspired by music, by art, when I'm writing, when I'm thinking about the scenes and the settings. My husband's a musician, and a lot of times, before I start each book, he'll make me kind of a playlist. I'll sit down at my computer and there'll suddenly be in my iTunes 10 songs about sort of that match the mood of my latest book. I just recently went to see this wonderful surrealist women's art exhibit at the LACMA here in L.A., which was great. And there's an artist I couldn't believe I'd never heard of named Remedios Varo that had some of the most inspiring paintings I've seen in a long time. But to answer your question, that heaven scene, I don't know where it came from. It didn't come from anything that I can put my finger on. It's very rare when you're writing that you get to do 100% invention. You're always working in a world that has laws that everybody understands, or a setting that, you know, people know the sky is blue here. People know that stoplights are red, or, you know, we respect and obey certain laws when we're writing. So writing about the fall of the angels from heaven, the great war, up in a place where no one has ever seen, was kind of freeing. And I don't know how it happened. I don't know how any of those images came to me, but I'm sure there's a lot of self-conscious material that went into it. But it felt brand new writing that scene. It was really exciting.
Okay, back to Bill, the mercurial Bill, who turned out to be Lucifer in disguise. I always thought there was something fishy, but so much fun about that character. I loved him. Did you always have a clear picture as to the role that he would play? Or did this Machiavellian side to him just slowly start emerging while you were writing his character?
I always knew who Bill was. I always knew what he was going to try to do. What I didn't know was why. Why he was invested in Luce, why any of it mattered to him, what he was doing in her announcer in the first place. And so I had to write through that. I had to explore in the first draft, really, what his motivations are. That's one of the things that I can never put my finger on it when I'm sort of outlining and planning for a scene. It has to come at the keyboard. Bill's voice came very naturally to me. It's so strange. He's such a weird character, and he's so very different from everyone else in the book, but I think I found him very refreshing and a really good character foil to Luce, especially because he is able to teach her so many things that would be very hard for her to learn on her own. But where they go together, especially in Rapture, I remember writing the final pages of Rapture thinking, I can't believe I'm doing this, but I think it's right. I'm eerily thrilled by what happens to Bill in the end.
Well, Lauren, on behalf of myself and all the myriad fans you have out there, I want to thank you so much for writing a series that allowed so many of us to fall in love with Daniel, with Cam, with Luce, and to live vicariously through this extraordinary girl's life. Was just an amazing journey. We're crushed it's over, but thank you so much for writing it.
Thank you so much, Justine. Your questions were insightful and interesting, and I've really loved listening to all the books on CD, and I love what you do with Luce's voice. Thank you so much for the generosity and enthusiasm you've brought to the series. I know everybody enjoys it.
This is Justine Eyre. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Rapture, a Fallen Novel, by Lauren Kate. This program was directed by Jessica Kay. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2012 by Tinderbox Books, LLC, and Lauren Kate. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.